Talk given Friday, 24th November, 1978. We all know the two phrases, the secular life and the religious life. And the majority of people in the world always imagine that the secular life definitely stands for one type of life, and the religious life for another type of life. This is a true statement only in this sense, that the secular life as understood and lived by the world is the life of ourselves in a subhuman condition, it is not the life of the full-fledged human. There are very few people in the world who understand the true meaning and full significance of the word human. And although several of us present here have heard me say this before, I think it will bear a repetition. The word human consists of two parts, hu, H-U, and man, M-A-N, man, which is directly derived from the Sanskrit root man, which is translated in the usual way as to think. But this is an extremely inadequate translation. The Sanskrit root man is the root of the word manyate, the verb manyate. And it is true that in ordinary parlance, manyate means to think. Now, our thinking is nothing but a stream of words, or a stream of visual images, or of sounds, or of tastes and touches and so forth. In other words, it is just the representation of our sense activity. Now, our sense activity is not the whole story. There is at least one, if not more, culminating in the Supreme One stage, in which the word to think has been used in the scriptures of the world through the ages to represent something quite remarkable. Because for us to think means to speak silently, inaudibly. We have used this kind of phraseology to describe, or shall I say, to represent creation by the primordial creative energy out of which the entire cosmos emerges. In these terms, if the person writing about it or talking about it is a theist, and God said, let there be so and so, and there was so and so. Now you and I can say, let there be so and so, till a million years later the cows come home. But that so and so will certainly not be there. There is another way of looking at these things. For instance, in the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, the Hellenistic form in which the original Egyptian teachings were put, God is referred to as All Father Mind, as the creative power. And they never say, and God said. They always say, and God created so and so. And in talking of man, it is said there, and all for God, who is life and light, All Father Mind, created man co-equal to himself, with whom he fell in love because he was so like his sire. Now, we've got a good hint there. And in the teachings of the Upanishads and the deep teachings of the East, including Zarathustrian teachings in Iran, we have passages in the scriptures in which the Supreme Being reveals his own nature. And one of the things he says is, I am the whole good creation. Now, if we were to say, and God minded so and so, light or whatever it is, and there was so and so, we get a different impression of the word mind, a different conception. It is not thinking in our sense of the term. It is a power which is dormant within us. Out of the few, this dormant power has come to fruition through living what they termed the religious life. And that religious life did not mean that they ceased to live in the world. They lived in the world, but had completely released themselves from all the flaws and defects of the subhuman condition. Now this is very, very important. We have to understand this. And having released themselves, found freedom out of this subhuman condition, which is a highly conditioned, limited state, they had realized, made real, the unconditioned state. And the extraordinary thing about this realization is that it is not that person's realization. The realization is the expression through that person of the supreme transcendent creative power, which is the unknown and unknowable by man with his brain, but which can be experienced by him. He can enter that condition. Such events in the world's history obviously have been rather rare. But now there we have a real indication of what is meant by the religious life. It is the life in the world as the fully fledged human being, man, to create rather than to think. And even the word to mind, the verb to mind, can be misleading, can be inadequate, because we naturally associate the word mind with our ordinary mental processes, our intellectual, emotional processes. Now, if that is clear, and I think that any intelligent person could see the logic of it, if that is clear, we can begin to appreciate one of the profoundest teachings in all the religions of the world. And that teaching concerns silence. How can one teach silence? Silence, I suppose, is best taught by being silent. But what does being silent mean? We, as we are, with our conditioned brains, immediately think of silence as the opposite of sound, whether that sound be harmonious or whether it be a cacophony, just noise. But this silence really means not merely the cessation of audible speech. We recognize that as silence, of course. Perhaps its very first meaning, the kindergarten meaning, the cessation of audible speech. But whilst we are awake, and also whilst we are dreaming, inaudible speech goes on. What we in our waking state call thinking, and in the sleep state we call dreaming, that goes on and on. So we can see that the next step in trying to understand silence is the cessation of both types of speech, the audible and the inaudible. What is the significance of the cessation of speech, whether audible or inaudible? All speech represents our sense experience. It is confined entirely to the impressions made on us through the functioning of the sense organs. And this functioning, which comes as so many impulses which reach the brain, all these impulses are synthesized in terms of audible speech, which consists of so many languages, each symbolical sound representing a sense impression. And it synthesizes all these into a meaningful pattern, as we call it, Therefore, we can communicate with each other if we know that language. And if we don't know that language, well, one of the parties concerned who is listening won't know what the other person is saying, or what is the meaning of something which is written in a language which we don't know. So the function of the brain is like that of a computer. It synthesizes all these sense impressions through the medium of speech. And speech is of the utmost importance in our ordinary, everyday life. It's indispensable. But we must fully appreciate what it actually stands for. Now, consider the quality of our speech. What does our speech represent? Our confusions, our fears, our emotions, our friendliness, what we call our good qualities as well as our bad qualities. Speech expresses the whole of the subhuman complex of vice and virtue, of what we call good and evil, the whole complex of our dualistic functioning in the subhuman condition. I say subhuman because here speech is not what we call prophetic speech. And prophetic speech, in actual fact, has nothing to do with predicting events in the future or performing any of those irrelevant tricks. Nothing to do with all that nonsense. Prophetic speech is that speech, whether audible or inaudible, or whether it is written down, is that speech which inspires the listener or the reader in such a manner that certain dormant sensitivities of the mind within him begin to thrill a little bit in response. His brain doesn't know what it is all about. But gradually, if and when that person takes himself in hand and lives the religious life in the true sense, which very simply is the virtuous life and no other, you see, in thought and word and deed, when he takes himself in hand like that, then that prophetic speech affects him extremely powerfully, and the scriptures of the world come to life for the first time for him. Until then, unless he lives the virtuous life, until then the scriptures of the world all too often make his confusion worse confounded. You know the good old English saying, the devil can quote scripture and he can quote it better than the angels can. Now isn't that true? So now consider then, this cessation of speech is not a static condition. Prophetic speech can always go on within the perfected human, the true human, in other words. And the living of a religious life, then, will mean that person's secular life, which is the utterly purified secular life. That is all. This is a very, very important point. we consider the troubles of the world. We consider our own personal troubles. Our troubles, our ill state, is the world's ill state and the world's troubles. Don't let us project everything outside and say, oh, it's that man, that institution, that country. Look at the whole fact. It is me, myself. It is because I am greedy that all the disasters which follow up in the trail of greediness emerge. Ambition, jealousy, envy, pride, all these things emerge out of greediness. And frustrated greed means violence. You see? So we don't need to blame the other fellow. In fact, if we do, we are doing wrong. We are making a great mistake. So, one has to start right with oneself, observing oneself, and seeing whether one's thought and feeling, one's speech and one's action is of such and such a nature or such and such a nature as the case may be. Observe very carefully. Now, there we have the key to the real meaning of cessation of speech, audible or inaudible, as signifying silence. But now we must go deeper. Is it merely the cessation of speech? What is involved in speech? Surely our oral sense, our sense of hearing. So that all our sense impressions are dominated by the words we make, and words are symbolical sounds which are the essence of speech itself. There's no such thing as speech without making a sound, you see. So our oral sense and the functioning of our oral sense has a profound influence on our understanding of silence. In fact, we have very little understanding of the true nature of silence, because we just associate it with the absence of sound. But is it just the absence of sound? Could it be also silence? I'm talking of silence. Could it be also the absence of sight? The absence of taste, of touch, of memory, of all our conditioning? Now, the absence of sight doesn't mean that we should be blind. Far from it. But the absence of the conditioning imposed upon the mind through our limited functioning of the sense of sight. When our own sense of sight functions at its fullest, at its most perfect, and is free of the, and in addition is free of all the conditioning imposed upon us from infancy as to how we shall interpret the actual experience of our sense of sight at work. Our parents, our teachers, our friends, they all tell us, oh, that means that, that means that, this is that, and we are conditioned that way. But if we start challenging that conditioning, and say to ourselves, is that all? Is there anything more? And if we remain quiet within ourselves, and this is the crux of the whole thing and the difficult part of it, if we remain quiet, we shall be astonished to discover how little we have seen. You know that famous story of the French professor of biology and a new young student, an eager student, came to him, and the professor said, very good, right, we'll start off. And he gave him something to observe. And he said, look at it, write down what you see and bring it to me. And the young enthusiast spent about 10 minutes or 15 minutes looking at it, wrote down a few sentences, and brought it to the professor. The professor read it very quietly, and without at all invalidating the student's personality, kindly, with great understanding, advised him to look at it again. He looked at it for an hour this time and brought a much more detailed account with a little apologetic statement that he didn't think that there was so much to see in it. And the professor went right through it and told him again, look at it again. And then this youngster woke up and he spent a whole week examining it very, very thoroughly and produced almost a large booklet of his observations. So now you see the implications that true keen observation, the deepening observation, meant that his first use of his sense of sight had been silenced by the deeper and more correct use of the sense of sight. So now, when we talk about the cessation of speech, we can just as well talk of the cessation of our sense of sight, of our sense of touch, and so forth. But the cessation, as I said, does not mean that you have shut down the operation of the sense. In fact, you have allowed it to deepen, but deepen in terms of truth, in terms of the fact, the actuality. And when that happens, what is one's own relationship to that which is being observed? Doesn't it become more and more intimate? It becomes more and more intimate. Your understanding deepens. And what does that imply? That you, the person, with your whole being, are increasingly in communion with that which you are observing through each and every one of your senses. And this communion is something which you don't achieve, but it happens, it emerges, because you have ceased to obtrude your own condition and conditioning and shortcomings upon that which is observed through the use of the senses. In other words, I, the individual who am observing, have ceased to obtrude upon the observed. I, the observer, so-called, am one with the observed. That is the state of unity, and that is the creative condition the condition of revelation. And God-minded, or if you like to use the Hermetic Trismegistic form of it, which is one of the nicest forms as a form, you see, and all-father mind, God, who is life and light, created man with whom he fell in love, because he was like his sire. So we see the meaning of the word human. At least one way of approaching the meaning of the word human. There are profound meanings to it. Now this sort of thing, this investigation into the meaning of the word human, is not very significant if we leave it at a level which has satisfied intellectual curiosity, or worse still, given us intellectual delight. Intellectual delight, spiritual delight, if you like, is a form of greed. Different in kind, but not in quality, from greed for intoxicating liquors or food or possessing power or possessions or dominating others or any such greed. Greed for power and all the rest of it. It's not different. It is greed. And as long as the individual says, I want to realize this state, this fully human state, he will never allow the realization, the making real, to take place. Because there's no such thing as I am the realizer. It is the supreme, one total reality, transcendence itself. If you want theistic terms, God himself, who is the realizer. And since God, in so many of the scriptures of the world, well, I shouldn't say so many, but several of the scriptures of the world, has declared that he is the whole good creation, obviously means that the totality, the one total reality, whatever it may be, is the realizer. And it comes to fruition through you, through me, because you and I do not obstruct. If we are the purified vessel, we are, to use the Christian phrase, each one of us is the Holy Grail. You don't have to go to some place on the earth to find the Holy Grail and bring it back. Legend and significant religious myth has presented it in that source, that form, in which, for example, you know the story of Parsifal. Parsifal goes and brings back the holy spear, which will cure the illness, and so forth and so forth. But each one of us is that Holy Grail. And how does that Holy Grail, how is it utilized? It has no bottom to it. It is no longer a limited container. It is an invisible, absolutely transparent condition of the mind, which is now no longer your mind, but the total mind. And you, the living person, are the nexus, the focus point through which the creative energy, the beneficence, and the reality, the truth of the one supreme primordial creative energy is manifest. We offer no obstruction to it. Consider how a cosmos functions. It is not unusual to talk of cosmos being created out of chaos. And the word created in that context for the vast majority of people means made out of nothing. No, that is a very misleading and a very inadequate way of talking about it. We can talk about it in less misleading and less inadequate ways. Note what I say, less misleading and less inadequate. No one can speak the whole truth like that. It's impossible. Because speech is something limited, and the limited cannot contain the unlimited. That is an obvious fact, isn't it? All right. So, to put it in less misleading forms, this is our task, and less inadequate terms. So now, here we get some sort of vision, if we care to let it come through, of cosmos, which is something manifested, emerging out of chaos in its primordial meaning, which is not disorder, but this creative energy, quiet, silent, eternity listening to its own silence itself, a state of vibrant quiescence of this creative energy. And then ask it, I don't know how, by self-limitation, self-constriction, cosmos emerges and visibility, time, space, matter all spring into being simultaneously. Modern science knows that. Thanks first to Albert Einstein and then to others who have followed him. What science has been presenting, particularly during the last 15 years, is astonishingly similar to, and in certain departments identical with, what the great religious teachers put forth far back as 3,000 years ago. The metaphysical part of science today, modern science, tallies completely or almost completely with the metaphysical statements of the old great teachers. And here we have the full meaning, that is to say, as full as a limited creature like myself can make it, of silence. It is the all-containing emptiness, the transparency, which is also the total fullness at the same time. Now, if you can really appreciate that, you will find yourself released from the fear of death, which is the fundamental fear ingrained in all living creatures. It's just natural to all living creatures, from which stems so many other troublesome qualities which we display. Qualities which characterize us in our subhuman state. but through the living of the virtuous life as such. This silence comes into full fruition, which means that you and I have fulfilled the purpose of our existence, one of the fundamental purposes, to be the Holy Grail for that eternal, immortal, creative energy which is transcendence.